It's the hopeful admonition of the Louisiana Code of Judicial Conduct that a judge shall be patient, dignified, and courteous to litigants, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, and others with whom the judge deals in an official capacity. Judge Frank Shea gave people nicknames.
I was the half-Jew, half-Yugoslavian whooping crane motherfucker. The judge whose number I just gave you was...
That would be retired criminal district court judge Frank Marullo.
He was Italian. His name was El Duce motherfucker. Judge Becker, who we just talked about, was that uptown blue blood motherfucker. There was a lawyer that practiced in his court named Chick Foray. A little bit short guy, does a lot of media stuff now. Because he was so small and looked like a jockey, his name was Eddie O'Carroll, motherfucker. Jimmy McKay was a judge. He's now the chief judge of Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. He had kind of a baby face. He called him that baby Huey, motherfucker. Everybody had a name that ended in motherfucker, and if it didn't end in motherfucker, that meant he didn't like you.
I'm Nick Krastel, and this is the Section G Podcast. Last week, the Section G Project looked back at Frank Shea's career on the criminal district court bench. This week, we're focusing on the experiences of lawyers who practiced in front of him, or, in some cases, were prevented from practicing in front of him.
You solemnly swear that you will truthfully answer all questions propounded to you between the state of Louisiana and the defendant at the bar, touching upon your qualifications to serve as a juror in this case. So out you go.
You are in the courtroom of Judge Frank Shea, Criminal District Court.
Defendants charged with crimes weren't the only ones who felt they were being sent to Shea's courtroom to be punished. In May of 1980, Kevin Boucher started an internship at the New Orleans District Attorney's Office.
So when I got to the DA's office, the assistant who handled it, I think in an attempt to wash me out, sent me to Frank Shea's court as punishment.
I talked with Boucher along with Judge Franz Zibelich together in the chambers of Zibelich's courtroom, which is Section L of the New Orleans Criminal Court. Zibelich started as a public defender in Shea's court in the mid-80s. Like Boucher, he remembered his assignment with Shea as initially punitive.
My father had gone to Loyola with Judge Shea. There was a gentleman named Numa Bertel who was in charge of the Indigent Defender's Office. And he and my dad were close friends. And they had probably, as of 1985, had both quit drinking alcohol for many, many years. And when I passed the bar and decided I wanted to go work in the Indigent Defender's Office, I think those two guys started drinking again because they sent me to Frank Shea. And it was really not where you would send somebody for their baptism. It was probably a place that you needed to be around some other places, but, you know.
It's baptism under fire.
Right.
It's baptism under fire.
Both Boucher and Zibelich grew to have an affinity for Shea. Like Zibelich, Boucher related Shea to his father, although that connection began on a more metaphysical level.
What she didn't realize is that Frank Shea was a reincarnation, or actually identical to my father, to the point that when my father met Frank Shea, they were like two long-lost brothers. And every time Frank Shea would yell at me or whatever, it was similar to Burt Boucher, go out and cut the grass. Damn it, get your ass up and cut the grass. They loved each other.
The paternal tough love, in the estimation of Zibelich and Boucher, was essential lawyer training.
You wanted to go into the cauldron? You went to Section G. And you were in the cauldron, and you knew you were in the cauldron. And, but by the same token, the lessons that I've learned, I've now practiced law in 37 Louisiana parishes. Nothing phases me. Judges give me 5 minutes to get ready. Been there, done that. Judges make you go to trial without your evidence. Been there, done that. Judges give you 5 minutes, been there, done that. Why? Because I graduated from the Frank Shea Academy of panic trial work, or whatever you want to call it.
The truth of the matter is, the guy was gruff. The truth of the matter is, he had the sort of sailor mouth that...
Curse like a sailor.
Would not work today. Mm-hmm. You know, his courtroom demeanor would not be considered appropriate today. But as Kevin said before, he was a little bit like a drill sergeant. We all respected him. You either loved him or you didn't. But he made you a lawyer.
As for Shea's demeanor, They chalked it up to a different era.
Well, it was a different world back then. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, you really only need to go back to the early 80s. Uh-huh. It was 12 white men sitting over here.
Yeah.
10.
10, really. 10 until 1996.
Well, Israel Augustine being the one exception.
Right. Uh-huh. We had one African-American male judge, and then we, in the 70s, and then we had a white Jewish female judge beginning in the 80s.
And of course, we had Judge Winsberg, another Jewish judge.
Right. But, I mean, for the most part, 60s and 70s, and obviously before, these were all white men.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely different culture. They could bring you in your chambers and talk however it is they wanted to talk until the advent of women lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it changed. It certainly changed that way for Frank Shea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could peel off MS with the best of them, but with the exception of one gal who happens to be a judge now, he wouldn't utter a curse word or swear in front of women. That was his upbringing.
That one gal who happens to be a judge now is Lori White. She's been presiding in Section A of the Criminal District Court since 2007. White worked as a prosecutor in front of Shea in the late 80s. Her recollection of him was less chivalrous. At a hearing testimony during a 2001 disciplinary proceeding for an Orleans Parish prosecutor, she recalled her time with Shea. "When I was the prosecutor," she said, "and I used to call it sentence to that courtroom to prosecute, Judge Shea didn't let women prosecutors prosecute there. But he apparently liked me and let me stay in there. He used to say that he'd run them off after the first couple of days." White called Shea the most hostile judge she'd ever been in front of. When I talked with her recently, she told me that Shea only allowed her to practice in his courtroom because he told her that she had, quote, a nice ass and a dirty mouth. Women weren't the only ones Shea attempted to run off from his courtroom. A number of other defense attorneys remember being in one way or another blocked from representing their clients in front of him.
"Your Honor, Nick Trenacosta represents Curtis Cottage." "No, you don't."
Trenacosta is a post-conviction lawyer. He was attempting to represent a man named Curtis Kyles in front of Shea after the Louisiana Supreme Court overturned Kyles' 1984 murder conviction and death sentence and ordered a new trial.
Yes, I do. I do represent him, Your Honor. I decide who represents him. Now, you appoint lawyers to indigent defendants. I'm representing him. I am his lawyer. Has nothing to do with you appointing a lawyer. He just went off. So, and I knew the law. You can't, the law on this is a judge can't tell a lawyer he can't represent a client. Unless the contemptuous behavior of the lawyer cannot be cured with sanctions, right? So I could do contemptuous behavior, but you still can't kick me off unless, but I didn't say anything. I said, "Well, what do you mean I don't represent him?" "That's right, you don't represent him." "You know, okay, well, Mr. Kyles has some motions he'd like to file." "He can file." "No, it can't. Only with a lawyer." He starts leaving the bench, and I start saying, "Let the record reflect the judges, you know, what is going on." He walks to the court report, he says, "Quit typing." I walk over, I said, "Keep typing." You know, and the poor guy, like I work for the judge kind of guy, you know. I never saw the transcripts. I don't know if they were ever produced of that event.
Shea stepped down from the bench before the case was retried. But after four additional trials, all ending in hung juries, the district attorney dismissed the charges against Kyles. It seems as though the transcripts from the incident Trenacosta described were produced. An article in the Times-Picayune, based on court transcripts and interviews with attorneys, reported the events just like Trenacosta described. The headline read, "Judge kicks lawyers out. Attorneys, Shea aims for speed." In the same article, Betty Cole, director of the Tulane Law Clinic at the time, told reporters that Shea was blocking her clinic from representing clients in his courtroom as well. We've had a problem with Shea for years that we don't have in any other court that I'm aware of, she said. He's never been friendly to the clinic, not out of any ideological basis, but because he likes everything to be familiar, and then he doesn't have to work that hard. Trent Acosta suspected that it was because Shea didn't want to have fierce advocates for defendants in his courtroom. Ron Rakowski, a defense attorney, ran into a similar situation in front of Shea.
Speed was everything then. It's really why I ended up, towards the end of his tenure on the bench, I ended up never handling anything to conclusion in his court because he ordered his minute clerk every time I came into his court, give me a new date, give Rakowski a new date, give him a new date, which as a defense lawyer, if your client isn't in jail, just say thank you and leave. But that was the result of some contentious trials that I had had in his court, after which he essentially never wanted to see me again.
Rakowski represented a man named Julius Peanut Carter, charged with murder in 1979. He was able to get the trial to drag out for a number of days through an intensive jury questioning, which Shea usually didn't allow.
And he just was furious that he had to do that. It didn't bother him that the guy was acquitted, and he was acquitted the second time. But he didn't want to go through that anymore if trying cases was going to take that long with me. Babe, give Rakowski a new date.
Near the end of his career, Shea was still demanding speed, but he wasn't holding as many trials. His main concern became having all proceedings done by lunchtime. Some lawyers began to develop theories about why that might be the case. Here's Gary Wainwright, who worked as a public defender back then.
He was always very tremulous. And, of course, in his chambers, when you walked into his chambers on the left-hand side, was a, to my recollection, was a small bar. And on top of the small bar were 50 bottles of pills. that were his medications. And, some of them were Valium. And back then, I can't remember what it would have been. There were benzodiazepines mainly. I never did inquire why he had all those pills. And of course, he would start shaking even worse, about 11:30, 11:45. And it was pretty, to my knowledge, pretty well known that when he had a driver, Jerry was a sheriff's deputy that drove Frank everywhere. And they would go straight from this courthouse to Mandina's. And they get to Mandina's for about 11:45, and the judge would, of course, it's New Orleans, and he would have a drink or two or more with his lunch, and that was pretty much, the daily thing that, from my observation over the course of years.
According to Wainwright, Shea came up with creative ways to make sure proceedings didn't extend past his lunch hour.
I'll never forget, it's funny. I was in the second day of an armed robbery trial. And we had picked a jury like Monday. And we came back and it was Tuesday. And the state was still putting on their evidence. And they were like in the most important part of the case where the guy was about to get asked to point at my client and say, that's the guy who robbed me. And Shea, who always, he stayed pretty like crouched down when he was in his chair, or slumped down, I guess would be a mark. But put it this way, if you wanted to see Judge Shea, you had to really sit up or stand up to see him when he was on the bench. And all of a sudden, I see him. He's like coming over the bench towards me. And he's saying, looking towards me. And he's going, and his hand is shaking. It's like a damn tambourine player. And he's looking at me and he's saying, Mr. Wainwright, Mr. Wainwright. It's about 11:45. Mr. Wainwright, do you have a motion to make? And I'm like, you know, just like, what the hell are you talking about? He says, emotion, Mr. Wainwright. I said, in a quizzical manner, mistrial? He said, granted. What the hell just happened? What the hell just happened?
Nick Trenacosta had similar suspicions about Shea.
He was always drunk. And he had neuropathy in his feet. So he walked like this. So he can't feel. He hit me on the bench and he walked off the bench like this. He's just a drunk.
You think he was drunk on the bench?
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit. I mean, he'd go to Mandina's every day for lunch and drink.
In one instance, during a post-conviction proceeding, Trenacosta said he actually followed Shea to Mandina's to find out what he was having to drink at lunch, in an attempt to gather evidence to get him off the case.
Well, you know, you slipped the busboy $5 and said, find out what he's drinking. Yeah, I was wanting to get as much evidence to get Shea off the case as possible. If I could have him drinking and then presiding in the afternoon, you know, that's what I was looking for. And the busboy comes back and says, bartender says, just ice for it. Here's $10. Go give it to the bartender and tell him to tell you the truth. Came back, the guy goes, it's gin. The whole thing is gin. Because they were protecting him a little bit, you know? They knew who I was. I didn't tell anybody. What's that guy drinking? Why do you want to know? Not important to you. Here's $5. Go find out. It's no big story.
A number of other attorneys I spoke to recall Shea going to Mandino's for lunch and his drinking. But many of them, including former Judge Calvin Johnson, say they never actually saw Shea intoxicated on the bench. According to the Louisiana Supreme Court, the Judiciary Commission has never filed any recommendation for discipline concerning Judge Frank Shea. Generally, any complaints that don't result in a recommendation of discipline remain confidential. Shea died in 1998, 2 years after his retirement. If Shea's behavior was so troubling to so many attorneys, why wasn't there any disciplinary action taken against him? Why wasn't there a movement to have him removed from the bench? In his 1972 campaign ads for judge against Frank Shea, Salvatore Panseca lamented the fact that he had not spoken out earlier about the judicial misconduct he had seen at the New Orleans Criminal District Court, and in particular, Shea's conduct. He gave two reasons for his previous silence. One was fear of personal reprisal. The other was fear that it would be detrimental to his clients. If you're a lawyer, he wrote, you often play the game according to the de facto rules, even if the de facto rules bear little resemblance to the ideals you learned in law school. Panseca died in 2011. Decades later, the reasons for silence haven't changed.
The idea that a lawyer who lives in a building with 13 courtrooms could pick out one of the judges, not pick out, but file some kind of complaint against one of the judges or against the district attorney and not have every single person you're trying to help be retaliated against is pretty far-fetched.
I'm Nick Crestel with The Lens, and this is the Section G Podcast. This series is supported in part by the Ella West Freeman Foundation and listeners like you. Show your support and give today at thelensnola.org/donate.